it's time for a bonus. A bonus episode. I love episodes of theater. We're going off the beaten path.
Off the beaten path.
We're off.
No, the problem, guys, the problem isn't just being ignored.
You're wrong.
I'll tell you.
I just tuned both of you out.
You're gaslighting me at this point. Okay.
You don't get to use that word.
There's no such thing as gaslighting. You made it up because you're fucking crazy.
Best Rick and Morty line.
Best Rick and Morty line ever. Just because it comes out so fast and so.
In case you couldn't tell, listeners, we're doing a bit. We're not mad at each
other.
We're bantering. We love each other. No, hi. It's good to see you.
Hey.
This morning, my alarm went off at 7, and I started uptown. And
you started.
I'm gonna
uptown.
I put in my 8 hours for the powers. Yeah, I've always been.
Yeah.
Till it's 5 p.m. You know.
Yeah.
And then I go downtown, which is where I am now. So.
I got the blackhead squeezed out of my ears.
Things will be great when you're downtown. You got the what?
I got the blackhead squeezed out of my ears.
I don't think you should have blackheads in your ears.
I saw my facialist before this. If anyone needs a skincare reco, I gotcha.
Okay.
We are not sponsored by Morgan Gonzalez, but Morgan's amazing.
We better be now. We should be able to pay our rent now. Rich dermatologist. Paying for sponsorship.
Is this how we want to start this episode? I don't know.
I don't know.
This is a pretty important episode, in my opinion. This is a huge part of my
life.
Segue and
that shit, dog. Segue.
We're gonna segue it in. This is a podcast about theater. Here we go. Welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Bertram.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett. Like CJ just dismissively, like just looking at her notes. Not making eye contact with any
prepping.
Of us.
You don't love us. It's fine.
Yeah,
I do. I just love indirectly.
No, we don't feel it.
But guys, you know what? We get together each week. That's why we love each other. We get together each week to discuss, we debate, we disseminate the evolutions of great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their plays. But we are not doing that this week.
No.
This is part two of our mini series.
Yes.
Turning musicals into movies.
Did we get that title right this time?
That's it. Turning musicals into movies. That's it. That's the one.
In part one was
movie musicals.
There was a lot of confusion. There was.
But part one was fun. I'm glad we got to talk Fiddler, and we talked so long that we were like, all right, we got to make two eps out of this. So this is our second episode in the miniseries. Normally we do two at once. I think this works. I think this is great. We're gonna put this out in the middle of the week. People are gonna be like, wait, what?
Yeah.
You dropped it on us.
All three people that wait for it to be dropped are gonna be so pumped.
Well, now more like four.
You're right, four.
Yeah. No, our numbers slowly ticking up. We're ticking up.
Ticking time bomb. Yeah, tick, tick, boom. That's our next miniseries. So, podcast. Today we're talking about something I am maybe one of my favorite things on the planet ever in pop culture. This is our episode on the movie Little Shop of Horrors.
I
was expecting like massive applause.
Well,
like,
you're getting
fireworks.
We just can't hear it.
We can't hear it. Okay.
There are people in their cars, or
they're all screaming, hooting, and hollering. I hear you.
And hollering, little goddamn shop of horrors.
Best little shop of horrors in Texas. this is. I want to hear your backgrounds with this because it's something that if you say it, people know it, and it comes from such a weird culty place, and now it's like a ubiquitous term, right?
Sure.
So I think charting this is going to be really fun. But where did y'all, what's your relationship with the Shop of Horrors?
Well, I'll start. I went with my dad to see the movie when the movie came out.
Yeah.
Because Frank Oz was directing it, and
Frank Oz's first movie without Jim Henson, to be clear.
That's right. And then Rick Moranis was in it, and he of course had already done Ghostbusters. Steve Martin, like the cast was just insane.
Yeah.
So you had to go see it, and then you're just like, "What? What did I just see?" And then soon thereafter, so this was the first musical that I ever did, and I did it like twice in two different, entirely different productions in over two or three years, one in high school and then one in college. And so it's just stuck with me. I had both the original cast recording and the soundtrack, of course. And yeah, I just was obsessed with it. All my friends, we were all just obsessed with it.
It's an obsessible thing.
Yeah.
Reminds me of Rocky Horror Picture Show, like in the cultiness and the love within the people that love it.
Yeah.
Weirdly, those shows kind of come from the same vein, right? Like it's
for sure.
Pulp kind of
sci-fi.
Looking back on 50s, 60s sci-fi. Yeah. Okay, totally.
We'll get there. Yes, I was very, very little when this movie came out, and I don't even remember the first time I sat down and watched it all the way through, but I do remember seeing Audrey and feeling so betrayed because I was such a huge Muppet fan, and I recognized Audrey as being the same type of creation as the Muppets.
Uh-huh.
And to be honest,
Audrey 2. Gotcha.
Audrey 2. Pardon me.
I'm
Audrey 2.
You're like, Ellen Green is not.
No, sorry. Pardon me. Audrey 2. Tui. But I was very small when I saw it. And like, we discussed this about E.T. The first 10 minutes of E.T. are so fucking scary to the point that that was the first thing I saw as like a 5-year-old. And then I never liked E.T. as a kid and now need to watch it as an adult. So this movie always scared the ever-loving shit out of me when I was little.
Yeah.
So like, honestly, sitting down and watching this, I couldn't even tell you when I've seen this all the way through. I've never seen it live, but going through this musical, recognize, I mean, I'd seen the dentist scene a million times, and I've heard all of the songs a million times, whether they were at cabarets or auditions or whatever. So it's something that's always been in the back of my brain, but not something that I enjoyed growing up because it's
so you've never seen a live production of the play?
I haven't.
Wow.
Because it's so different.
It is so different,
and
it's
that's
so
what
fun.
Frank Oz wanted originally. The original ending that he shot.
We'll get there. There's so much to say about that. Yeah. This for me, this is a big one. Another big one. Fiddler and Little Shop are huge for me. I think this was one of the first musicals I saw on stage. My brother was in it. He's 8 years older than me in the high school. He was just in the ensemble. He was like a freshman in high school. So I was pretty young, right? I would have been 6, 7, 8, something like that. And I went and saw it. And the plant, I just was blown away by. I actually believed this thing was on stage, and I couldn't. It was absolutely incredible.
That's so cute.
And I remember at the end when the people came out of the vines to show that they were the puppeteers. It was my brother's twin friends, Anna and Kathleen, who I knew very well. So I was like, what? And then my not like in a bad way. I was like happy about it. I was like, whoa, it was them the whole time. And then my older brother's best friend, Jordan, walked out and he was the voice of the plant. And so all of a sudden, like, my mind just exploded as a child. And I just loved the show. I made my parents buy me the movie after that. Because I was just like, well, there's a movie? Buy it. And it stars one of my favorite actors? Buy it. So Rick Moranis, not Steve Martin. I did like Steve Martin, but Rick Moranis was huge for me.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Come on.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Parenthood, weirdly. Yeah, yeah, it's like a movie that my family watched a lot. But yeah, and Spaceballs and Ghostbusters and just all of that was just huge in my household. My Blue Heaven, the which
also
is based
Steve,
on the same... Also with Steve Martin, did you know that My Blue Heaven is based on the same source material as Goodfellas and is technically a sequel to Goodfellas?
Yeah.
But it's a comedy
crazy.
Starring Rick Moranis and Steve Martin. Just a thing that we should all talk about sometimes.
Yeah.
Anyway, I love you both. Thanks for doing this podcast with me.
Yeah. Are we done? No.
Yeah, we're done.
Bye, everybody.
See you later. Little Shop.
Little Shop of Horrors. Little Shop.
No, but I saw it a few more times growing up. Always loved it. Always had fun. But it was always just the show, right? Everyone just kind of puts up what they know, and it's the thing. And at the end, like, we'll talk about, you know, they come out with the flowers around their faces, and you're like, oh, ha, ha, ha. And a lot of community theaters, a lot of high schools. I finally got to see a really phenomenal production at the Kansas City Rep Theater, which Rachel Bertram was the assistant director for. Did not know her yet. Funny story.
Oh. Cute.
I wrote a whole paper on this because they conceptualized it in such a way that it, like, reinvigorated my excitement about it. They made Audrey 2, the voice of Audrey 2, was on stage with the band and was dressed in sort of nightclub, jazz club attire and was singing into an old-time mic the whole time, nice. But was acting with the puppet, and it was cool.
Oh, that sounds
cool.
That's
we were, like, idea, yeah. like, turning with it and stuff and, like, really acting. That was really fun, and it was really interesting casting, and they did some cool stuff with the set. So it was reinvigorated for me. And then I saw it again at the Pasadena Playhouse. What, maybe 4 years ago now?
It was like four.
Right before I started there with MJ Rodriguez and George Salazar. And although I don't think the puppet design was perfect, it was absolutely incredible to watch. The puppetry
was
awesome. Yeah. And the concept was awesome. And the casting was really cool. And MJ Rodriguez fucking destroyed it. And you can look it up on Google. They went on James Corden and performed Suddenly Seymour. And it's one of the best Suddenly Seymours out there. Highly recommend checking it out. But a couple years before that, funny story, I directed Little Shop of Horrors.
Ooh.
Wow.
In Thousand Oaks. At the Hillcrest Center for the Arts, the 200 theater.
Quite a drive.
I was in NoHo, and it was like a half hour each time. It wasn't so bad, but it was a little 200-seat house. I had produced a couple things with this company before. I had directed Figaro in that same space. And this producer called me and said, hey, what show would you do if I told you I just want, like, I want to put up a musical? And I gave him like three or four. I think Next to Normal was on the list. And I think Tick Tick might have actually been on that list because I was kind of obsessed with Tick Tick in that moment. And so this is like maybe 5-6 years ago. He said, I like Little Shop. Let's do Little Shop. And I was like, oh, great. Okay, cool. So my choreographer and I got together and we reconceptualized the whole show.
Cool.
We made Audrey 2. Sort of a metaphor for addiction and drugs, like literally drugs. So we made it real dark. We kind of took, I mean, it was still funny. We made it schlocky, but we kind of took all of the, everything you think of when you think of Little Shop was gone. So it was no longer set in the 60s. It was set in the 90s. We reorchestrated the music with a 90s rock band sound. So this guy got a band together and they fully re-orchestrated all of the music. We updated all the look, all the everything. We moved it back to LA, which is originally where it was set, actually. Mm-hmm. The movie moves it to New York and then everybody puts it in New York after that. But actually, it's meant to be set in LA. And
that's why I thought the Skid Row thing was...
Yeah, it's kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
But there's... I think they were trying to make it a little more fake. Like, this is not a place that really exists, even though it fully does in Los Angeles. One of the, in fact, the worst slum in America. You know, it's absolutely terrible. We'll do a whole other podcast on that someday, or donate some money, or just, holy shit, or some socks. I actually just did an interview for a job where I was saying, they said, "What is your most proud thing you've ever put up?" As a producer, director, anything, I said, oh, Little Shop of Horrors. Like, it was just, everyone was on the same team. Everyone got each other. The cast got it. The people who saw it, who didn't like it, their notes were like, no, I loved it. Like, everyone was great, but, like, it wasn't Little Shop. And I was like, thanks. You know, right. It was that kind of feel. And I felt like I could do that in a 200-seat house in Thousand Oaks.
Sure.
I feel like with something like Little Shop of Horrors 2 that's so iconic and everyone knows exactly what it is, that's way more interesting to me if you're like, I'm going to put my own spin on it, whether it's casting or a different feel. Like, I think that's a great fucking idea.
We got one Broadway World review that was like, because it was during Fringe Festival that year. And we got this review that was like, you want to see some real art? Drive to Thousand Oaks. And I was like, whoa. Nice. Like, it called out Fringe Fest. They were like, Fringe Fest is great, but you want to see real shit. And I was like, oh cool. Nice. But
what year was that? I want to argue with
I know. Well, that was that was kind of what we said. We didn't even post that review because we were just like, you know, that's rough. Because I had a lot of friends doing Fringe that year. No, well, you were going to say something, Scott. I apologize.
Oh, no, it's all right. I think that's one, the only drawback to it, and I applaud you for trying to do something. I applaud anybody for trying to do something with it, because what happened was the musical was very successful off Broadway, but then as it started to tour, as there started to be regional productions of it and that sort of thing, the problem when the movie came out was then from that point on, everybody was doing the movie on stage.
Right.
And it from concept to, you know, all the way through, like I've seen it several times, and it wasn't until years later that I saw a production that actually did the ending that's
really?
The play. Yeah, a lot of people a lot of people did the movie ending.
Whoa.
What's the ending in the play?
Well, they all get
everyone gets eaten, and then the world gets taken over by Audrey too. I don't want to get too deep into the ending, because I want to explain later the ending that was supposed to be in the movie that didn't happen.
They kind of hint at it a little bit,
but that's not what happens. Everyone lives in the in the musical. Everyone dies.
But then
every
the little plant smiles
dies.
At the camera at the end.
Right.
It's like,
they hint at the idea of like, but that's the end of a sci-fi schlock or horror kind of, but you're right. But they did. Oh, God damn it. We're talking about the ending. Okay, fuck it. Let's do it.
Well,
the ending.
Let's do this. Let's take a step back to the original movie. Roger Corman movie that launched it all.
Right. It's based on the 1960 Roger Corman film of the same name. I'm a big Corman fan.
Oh, you can't help but
okay. This movie, the original movie, 1960 film, is famously shot in 2 days and is Jack Nicholson's first time on screen.
Yep. No shit.
Who does he play? The Bill Murray role. The part of the guy who goes
which
in.
Is my favorite.
Pulled.
The masochist.
Cameo.
The masochist. Now, in the original, it's, you know, this is Corman. This is the guy who did Buckets of Blood. This is the guy who did, right, you know, it's not a gory film, to be clear, but it is darker and feels, it's really tonal.
It's not serious. It's definitely a comedy. It's definitely a black comedy.
Agreed.
And
he's still silly. It's a little schlocky, but that's little, Corman.
But it's dark and fucked up too. And you know, he's talking a lot about you know, the state of America, the state of the American dream. You know, the state of consumerism and all of that. Like, he's getting into some heavy themes when you think about it. And
absolutely.
And it kind of kept
which is
going
what Corman
around.
Did, right? Corman put up schlock that actually had legitimate meat behind it, right? And I think the film itself was kind of seen as that, as just like schlock at the time. It was kind of just like, oh, okay. You know, it did well because it was Corman, and his stuff had a little cult following. But it took time for that to really gain a point where somebody was like, let's write a musical about it, right?
Yeah.
So they when they are writing this musical, Ashman and Mankin, they are trying to reference Corman, period.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they're just like, we're putting a Roger Corman film on stage as a musical. And what I love about this film, to digress for one moment, is that the film is almost a perfect amalgamation of theater and film. It's very cinematic.
Yes.
It is.
For 86, it's still very cinematic, but it all feels like it's on a stage.
Yes.
It all feels like it's on a set built 2 days ago that's the paint's still drying, and you know, and it all feels a little bit like an off Broadway show.
Well, the singers that wander around, the trio that wanders around the whole time definitely brings you into the
Greek
theater
chorus.
They're fucking great.
Yeah, they are
amazing.
Great. Yeah. But but to get back to what you were saying, Scott, like, so we have this film. Years later, they make this musical, and what, and then the movie comes out, and then everybody starts doing the movie on stage. What I wanted to bring it back to, and I know it's referencing a 1960 film, but the themes that the 1960 film we're trying to say are still relevant today.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Which is why this musical is still relevant. And so I had a couple notes from people, like specifically Barry Pearl, a good friend of mine. He was one of the T-Birds. He's Duty, the T-Bird, in the movie Grease. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he's a great dude. And he came to see Little Shop. And afterwards, he was like, let's talk. And I was like, okay. And he was like, I loved a lot about it, but here's the problem. If you don't set it in the 60s, none of the references make sense. And I said, I hear you. But don't you agree that all the way through the 90s, probably up till September 11th, the idealism of, which is what everybody wants right now, right? Make America ideal again, what we thought it was again. The idealism was still alive from the 50s and 60s. People were still pretending like the nuclear family was intact and everything's great and heterosexuality rules and we're all doing great. Everything's fine.
Yeah.
And our economy rocks and, you know, and all this of kind it, of stuff. Yeah. So even though there's still slums, right? But everything's great. Mm-hmm. And the Somewhere That's Green theme of the wish of something more, that nuclear family life, the green grass, the fence, the house that looks like an old, basically what they're explaining is like, I want a plantation house, right? Like I want a white house with balconies and a picket fence.
White picket fence. And
Jesus, right? You know. So, but we, that was all broken a little bit after, you know, in the 2000s and especially now. But I was like, okay, the beginning of this show says, and I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot, but then I'll shut up. The beginning of this show says, what is the opening line of the narration? It's like a few decades ago.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In a year not too distant from our own, or, you know, whatever the thing is. I'll look it up. I feel stupid now. But the opening line of it basically says like 30 years ago.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
That's kind of just what it says. And you're like, then that's the 90s now. And it worked. A lot of people didn't get it. I got it. It was a small thing in Thousand Oaks.
I think it totally works. It's also just the cycle of trends. Like, we're living in the 90s again right now.
Right. Yeah,
Back totally. To the Future was 85, and they were looking back at 55. Like, I think it works perfectly, Bailey.
Also,
I would have told your friend to shut the fuck up.
Yeah, Barry Pearl from Greece.
Not really, Barry.
But the last thing I'll say about it that I was really proud of is... we got this huge, massive plant that was fucking incredible. It was actually a Jim Henson. It was a Henson made puppet.
Cool.
So it was just like, it was a rental, but it was massive and beautiful and looked like a psychedelic drug. Like it was, mm-hmm. It had giant glittery Muppet lips. Like it was that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it was super fun, but to hide it, we did this thing when you walked in. There was this huge shelving unit, like a window that, like, if you were walking down the streets of Skid Row and there was a window with TVs behind it, right? Mm-hmm. And we had all the TVs playing 90s commercials and news updates and trailers for the movie Wolf with Jack Nicholson and, like, all this stuff, like, trying to put people right in 1994. Like, these are the shows that are on right now. These are the whatever. But it was also a dual... purpose because it hid the plant for the beginning of everything.
Right.
But I was just, that was one of the cools that we did rear projection for it all. So all these TVs looked like they were changing channel constantly. Oh, I don't know. It was good, y'all.
Sounds
it
like
was
great.
Good. I was really proud of it. I have a trailer for it that I show people all the time when I'm like, here's what I'm proud of. Here.
Oh, right on.
It was very, very cool. Anyway, that's all I have to say. What else?
That's a lie. I feel like you'll say other stuff.
You're right. I'll put tape over my mouth. Hold on.
No.
Yeah, I think for me, what has always been the success of the film is the casting.
Yeah.
That you would put Rick Moranis, who at the time you wouldn't have thought of as a musical theater person at all.
Right.
He was almost exclusively the Second City, you know, Dave and Bob, Ghostbusters at that point.
Right.
But Ghostbusters was certainly his biggest thing at that point.
I think you're right.
Which fits into Little Shop of Horrors, too.
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, so much of that same crew and, and your group of folks.
Just the feel, like, dealing with spooky shit, ghosts, and now we got this weird man-eating plant. Like, it all works.
Yeah, totally. And then that Frank Oz kind of fought for Ellen Green because everybody's like, who? No, we're not going to put her
Jennifer Tilly has played that role before, right?
I don't think so. I don't think she'll sing like that.
She absolutely should.
I don't know if she sings, but I just kept seeing her in that.
Ellen Green, who we have talked about on this podcast, do y'all remember why? But the biggest one, do you remember the reason we got, like, we kind of did a deep dive in Ellen Green one time? It was an Instuff. It was a Scott pick.
Oh, was it the boomer funeral?
Oh, talk radio.
Talk radio.
Oh, no. I was thinking of the, I was like, was she one of the ladies in the boomer funeral movie?
No, she.
What is that? Oh, fucking The Big Chill. No. It was Talk Radio, y'all, season two.
Yeah.
Love that.
Oh shit, that's right.
Bugosi. Yeah.
And she, you know, worked. I mean, she still works quite a bit. You know, on stage, and you see her pop up.
She still does film Audrey sometimes.
And she still does Audrey sometimes. She's
she and Jake Gyllenhaal did it in L.A. Eight years ago.
That's right. Yeah.
And they cast the plant as just a dude in a giant green furry like pimp jacket, and he just sang at them. It was kind of cool.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, that casting, and then all of the stunt casting, the Christopher Guest walking in.
Yeah, holy shit! I mean, but Christopher that was before Guest Christopher wasn't Guest was Christopher Guest, right?
Yeah, like he'd done Spinal Tap and Saturday Night Live, and a couple other things. But
so he's buddies with Frank Oz.
Of course,
Guest, Steve Martin, and John Candy were all just buddies.
Oh, and John Candy! Talk about a face from my childhood.
If you go look at the current DVD and Blu-ray that's sold of Little Shop, not the old one with the plant grabbing everybody, but the newer one that they sell, it's Rick Moranis with the plant next to him, and then there's three heads above him. It's Ellen Green, Steve Martin, and John Candy. They could have put anybody else there. They put John Candy. But it's funny. John Candy gets that one great scene. Chris Guest, Steve Martin. And then you get Belushi, who was only in it because it was supposed to be, I think, Paul Dooley. And then they had to do reshoots of those scenes for some reason. And so he couldn't do it. And so they're like, we'll just call Jim. So they called Jim Belushi.
It's like,
Belushi.
I kept seeing Henry Dittmann in Steve Martin's role.
He'd be great.
So when Henry and I did it back in the day, he played Seymour. I played the dentist.
Really?
I
love it.
Yeah.
He'd be a good dentist. Pictures. Our take on the... please send. We will Instagram the show.
Yes.
Our idea was that the dentist was a back alley dentist. He wasn't a real dentist.
Okay.
So you'd go see him if you didn't have the money to pay for real dentistry.
Yeah, of course.
So he could be shitty to you.
But, well, you had to deal with the fact that he was going to be shitty to you.
That was the whole
thing. And he had like a drill with a thing at the end. And we were like, I mean, we went weird with it. And then we did this whole bit since, you know, there's a piece of this show, of this movie that kind of sucks is that it does like, delete some good things, but it also adds some really interesting stuff that's not in the musical. And I think, you know, we, to pay homage to that, we did like a little masochist moment where somebody was already in the chair as Seymour came in and they were getting a literal drill in their mouth. Uh-huh. And then we had her sit up and the ensemble we made like fucking crazy. And she sat up and she just spit blood everywhere on the stage. It was awesome.
That's cool. That's awesome. because they cut that, they then cut the duet between the dentist and Seymour.
That's right.
Give him the gas and all that.
Well, there's two different versions of that song.
Yes, there are. Yes.
Musical is a little scarier. It's a little darker. The one in the movie is a little more, or the way they do it in the movie is a little more just like get to the point. But there's a huge whole song in there and there's two versions of it. There's also this song that gets cut at the end that is called something.
We'll have tomorrow in the musical.
No. It was in the original version of the musical off Broadway and got cut after that. And it was never put back in. And they use it as a theme throughout the movie. I'm going to play it at the end of this episode. How about that?
Fucking do
it. Put it at the end of this episode. Because it's never been, it's not produced anymore as a thing. So I think we can do that without rights. Keep going, y'all. You said casting, Scott. So the best part of this casting to me is the ensemble.
For that sure. That's
opening
yes.
number, Skid Row, with all the people with their sunken eyes and they're doing that kind of glitchy.
I loved the choreography a lot.
Yeah,
it was choreo to us for a sexy.
Very Michael Jackson's Thriller kind of choreo, which
for sure.
makes sense at the time, of course. And
I just dig choreography that, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, I everybody knows this, doesn't necessarily have to be pretty, and it doesn't necessarily have to be complicated. And everyone was so good and so ultra committed in such a kitschy, silly kind of way that it popped and it worked and it had me, like, I was laughing out loud watching it. I was enjoying it so much.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, totally.
And the three, what they're called in the script is the three urchins.
Urchins, yeah.
It feels a little weird to call them that, right? You know, the idea is like street urchins, you know, in like
sure.
a Christmas Carol kind of way. But
I loved all their costumes. They changed costumes every
amazing.
Time they were on camera.
Yeah, yeah. And their
I
hair is amazing.
Yeah.
And their voices are incredible. And the movement's incredible. But when they are playing the teenage girls,
yes.
that might be some of the best acting in the movie.
It's real.
It's
so not put
real.
On at all. Yeah.
Because everyone in the shop and coming into the shop is very fake. Christopher Guest comes up and he's like, "Hi. What's that beautiful thing in your window?"
Sure,
right?
Sure,
but
sure.
they come up and they're like, "No, don't fuck with us, dude. Like, we don't want anything to do with you. Like, go back in your shop. We don't
This guy
we don't
is
go
bad for your health." That was
yeah,
my favorite
she's, they're
line.
Like really honest with
Audrey
and oh God, it's so genius. This the whole thing is set up really well. The chiffons, the Ronettes, and the crystals, if you will, they were the old trio doo-wop girl groups
yeah.
from the 60s.
Yeah.
So then there's Chiffon.
Well, and yeah, I liked it too. I mean, there wasn't one of them that was the leader. All of them sang their asses off and got their moments in the songs as
for
well.
For sure.
Right. I love those songs that they get and the mm-hmm. harmonies that they get. And you can get some really fun choreo out of them. We did sort of like they are TLC. In our, you know, they are early
the
Destiny's Child. Yeah, but for the 90s, for
Did
our
you put
episode.
Them in
I got
overalls
you.
With a
yeah.
sweatshirt that was cut off right
One
underneath
of them
the
was,
ribs.
Yes, yes.
Don't
we actually had a moment where we almost put...
waterfalls.
Don't go chasing waterfalls. I almost put one of them in an eye patch, and then we were like, nah.
The first time I ever choreographed anything when I was 10 years old, we did a dance to the entire song What I Really Want by Alanis Morissette from Jagged Little Pill. I was 10 years old. There was three of us, and we dressed up like TLC. We had overalls and
sounds appropriate
cut off sweatshirt.
Yeah.
We got made fun of and I didn't choreograph until like 20 years later after
Aww.
That.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it was incredible choreography, so I'm sorry that you were stifled
yeah,
for so
that's
long.
10-year-olds dancing to What I Really Want by Alanis Morissette.
At my
really
second...
inappropriate season.
No. At my second grade talent show, I got up on stage with my friend Jake Boxberger, and we danced to the song "Men in Black." But what were we doing? He was dressed as a man in black, in a tux and everything. I was dressed in a full black morph suit as his shadow, doing a different dance.
That's kind of fun.
It was cool, but when I think back on it, I'm like, I'm sure that was frickin' horrible. And embarrassing. And I just don't remember it all. Little chubby Bailey in a morph suit, like, yeah, Men in Freaking Black. By the way, I got the Men in Black steelbook in the mail. Hold on.
Of course you do. Our dance group was freaking called the Red Hot Sundays.
Look at this. I know you can't see it on
it's
the podcast,
fun.
Y'all, but this is one of the... I'm going to post it on the...
That's
it's
very pretty.
It's pretty.
It's so cool. And it's the 25th anniversary, and that means that movie's been out for 25 years.
Wow. Wow.
That was like one of my favorite tweets I saw lately was Macaulay Culkin said, "Hey, if anyone wants to feel old, I turned 40 today. You're welcome."
Macaulay. Yeah, that's great. I miss him. I do. I follow him on stuff, but I miss him in stuff. I feel like he would bring like really interesting vibes to
call us
films
Macaulay
these days.
We can let's put you in some fucking theater.
Yeah.
Remember Party
Monster? He pops up every once in a while.
Oh yeah, Party
His Monster. Brother's the one though. His yeah. brother overtook him.
Brother Rory him. And Kieran both had better careers at basically because they yeah. just they kept going. Okay.
Digressions. Digressions.
Obviously, like we should do a little deeper on the cast, but I want to talk puppetry for a second.
Yeah.
Can we do that? What was y'all's take on this puppetry?
Oh, it was amazing. Because I think if people, it's interesting to watch because I remember seeing it pre-CGI. There's a point where Jurassic Park ruined a lot of things for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Because it's a horrible movie. It's not a good movie.
Wow.
But, yeah,
another movie that scared
it,
the
I'm
shit out of
it,
me.
And I'll prove it. I can prove it mathematically.
Wow.
I can prove it through numbers. But that there is no CGI.
As
There's
art
not
should
a...
be. As art should be discussed through numbers and math.
If you're calling Jurassic
ahead,
Park art.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Then we're already.
There's art there.
There's kind of. It was amazing to watch. There's not a lick of CGI in it. Not a lick of CGI anywhere in that movie.
And if this was made now, it would be.
It would totally. It would all be.
Would it? Because I feel like all of that shit is coming back a little bit. Like we've been talking about
it.
Well, that's what I mean. Like that's kind of what I love about Star Wars. Even like an Obi-Wan Kenobi, even though it has nothing to do with any of the Muppets are in it. You're walking through this scene, and all of a sudden, you can see Henson Studio going, "Hey guys, we're still here," and it looks great.
It does. They are. I feel like what's happening right now with Disney and Star Wars and the practical puppetry that's happening, which I love. To be
I love
clear.
It too.
Babu Frick is one of the best things to happen to that universe. Even
my
though he's
God,
in the
are you trying to
universe.
Enrage me right now?
No, no. If you delete everything else in that movie but Babu Frick, best movie in the franchise. So
except for the porgs,
all right,
which
all
are
right.
CGI.
You're kind of right.
Yeah.
Like it's an entertaining character, but unfortunately,
I just like him.
Even its placement in that movie.
No, you're right.
It's so
work.
Bad. It's just like, oh, I just hate it.
Just as a practical
take it,
effect.
Drown it in the car.
Right,
drown
and
it
you
outside.
Know, we have obviously Lucas goes and takes the old films and put re-releases them with CGI over all the puppets, and we're all like, and at first, I think people were kind of into that. They were like,
that was
whoa,
the time.
Jabba looks like he's actually a slug
he's
moving
living.
Around. It's like, no. And it now if you watch that shit, you're like, what?
It this looks is... so bad.
Well, it's like
so
watching
bad.
All of the early Harry Potters and stuff when all of that shit was first coming
There's
out.
There's some bad stuff. But at the time, I thought it I was like, this
sure.
is the best CGI that's
sure.
ever happened. Yeah.
But I'm hoping, I mean, I agree in that the puppetry in the movie is fucking incredible. And yeah. I hope, I don't know, I hope people kind of go for that. It's like every time fucking Wes Anderson comes out with a new stop animation film that
sure.
it's like... You realize all the handiwork and patience that went into that. And
absolutely.
I just, it's beautiful and it's amazing. And I hope people
I think
bring it back.
Audrey
more.
2, maybe I'm, you know, I could be way off base here. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is Audrey 2 maybe the best practical animatronic ever in a movie?
I might argue Jabba, which is, I think, the same
only
people.
Because the time is so much earlier.
It's only 3 or 4 years earlier. We're not talking.
Right,
to
but,
oh,
but
yeah, that does.
I guess
sound
that's
about
true.
Right.
I guess you're right. I guess that's true.
And I think that some of the same puppeteers are doing both of them.
I think.
But
you're
no,
right.
I think it's right up there with it because it's also Jabba's trying to look like a real thing in a real. And,
true.
And there's
yeah,
a bit
yeah,
of
yeah.
color and a bit of. I hate to use the word cartoonishness in it, but there's, you know, to Audrey too, but there's a little bit of that. That
but he's a plant from motherfucking space.
He's a plant from motherfucking space.
I mean,
he's a mean green mother from outer space.
Yeah. Oh, I have an Audrey 2 question.
That's also not in the musical that was written for the movie. Go ahead.
Yes.
Was Audrey 2 the birth of the phrase tough titties? And if not, where the fuck did that phrase come from?
It was
oh,
not.
I think it was not. That thing was, that was around for a long time.
But I remember as a child when we watched it together, my mom was like mortified that he's, cause he also
tough
says like
titties.
Tough titties, bitch. Like he like really gives it to him. Levi Stubbs. Let's shout out Levi
oh,
Stubbs.
Yeah, I was about to.
Incredible.
He was one of the Four Tops or one of the Temptations.
Four Tops. The Four Tops. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. And you know, the what's really cool about this is the puppetry. So he did the voice first, and then they had to mimic the mouth movements and the lip movements. And so everything is on tons of wires. Like little tiny wires for every little piece of the lip. There's another wire that gets pulled. It's like all this, these tiny little movements. And you basically have people behind it like churning butter to make it all happen. Like they're all on like ellipticals being like trying to get these things to move. So because it took so much to make every little movement, this whole, all the scenes with the plant where it's speaking are shot in 16 frames per second.
Oh, wow.
Everything else is shot. Everything, normally, we watch movies in 24 frames per second. Unless you're watching the Hobbit movies or Gemini Man or something that Ang Lee shot in 120 or whatever. There's like really high frame rates now, but most people still just do 24. And you can barely feel it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like it's only minorly feels like stop motion, but not in a... not in a real way where they're actually doing picture, 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 but it's a little closer to stop motion because it's 16 rather than 5 or whatever stop motion is, right?
Huh.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Very fun. This came out around Christmas. It was meant to be a huge summer blockbuster, and it got pushed. So it comes out around Christmas, and it's a disaster.
Musicals are good around Christmas.
It would have been well, but it's not a hit at all. Huh. It's disastrous. Nobody really goes to see it. It dies after the first weekend. And most of this was because of the test screenings and how much negativity came out of the test screenings.
Because of the ending.
Because of the ending.
People are stupid.
No shit. All right.
So people walked out of the test screening. It was disastrous. People were walking out being like, no, no, you cannot end the movie this way. I hate this movie. I hate this. Everyone, no one should ever see this film, right? They were like, what'd you think of the rest? Oh, no, everything was really great. Till the end. And there's a couple other things that they actively changed for. They did a lot of reshoots before the actual release. But the final ending in the movie, in the musical, everyone gets eaten. And then the Greek chorus come out and they sing this song that's like, and then Audrey 2 took over everything. And it was in every household, and everybody's gonna die. And then, like, vines fall from the ceiling, and that's the end of the show, right? Don't feed the plants is the final song. So the movie, he goes, well, we have a budget. This is a major summer blockbuster at the time. That was the goal. This is gonna be a major summer blockbuster. We can do anything we want. The ending is a giant Godzilla film. So it is a giant Audrey 2 with root legs, destroying New York City
with people in its hands. Yeah.
And it is awesome. And they're singing really Don't Feed the Plants. It's you can get it on the Blu-ray. It's on the Blu-ray now. If you can watch it with the original ending if you want. It's like a setting. And it's awesome. You can watch it on YouTube. Everybody go watch it. It's so fun. And I would have loved it. But it goes to that thing where on stage, audiences are more used to the idea of an unfinished ending, a sad ending, because then we get to applaud and see them all come out and take bows, right? Sure. So they get their big applause. At the end of that movie, everyone was just dead. New York was gone forever, and it was about to take over the world, end of film. And people were like, roll credits? No, bring them all back out. Bring them all back out for Disney movies. Yeah, where's this happening?
They need a wedding at the end.
Yeah, and so it's just interesting to think about when we talk about the meshing of film and theater that this movie does so well. You have then the inability to actually do the stage show story and ending because audiences just won't accept it the same way.
Right.
So interesting to me.
Oftentimes, yeah, I mean, probably a different crowd seeing it some of the times. I mean, I'm sure there were theater fans that came to see this because they liked the musical, but yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this the best, like, adaptation of a musical to movie that doesn't feel the need to make it all just, like, realistic? You know how, like, Fiddler just makes it just the most real. You're in Anatevka. It's just that. This still feels like a musical like musical
theater.
Yeah,
it's big. And yeah, it's very stylized. All of the acting is very, it's quite big and for camera. I
think if they remade this movie now, they wouldn't allow that.
Well, and I think that that's why there's some classic movie musicals that don't work especially well, or at least have not held up especially well, because they're trying to make it smaller. And it I think that this is one of my notes for next week, spoiler, but for Into the Woods, I think the problem with Into the Woods is that they're trying to make these moments intimate that aren't intimate. They're huge. And they're huge, you know, on stage. And I don't know.
Importance of Being Earnest. Not a musical, but like the way they did it in 2002, where they're trying to make it more like realistic, when it's like you're used to seeing it on stage and everyone's playing these big, melodic, loud characters.
Right. You know, yeah, I dig it when people do more stylistic kinds of stuff on screen, that because they're also became an association with realism on film, realism. Sure. And then there's a point where you're just like, okay, I've seen enough realism, because and I'm not talking about like Star Wars or fantasy. I'm talking about the actual art, the actual structure.
I'm actually a little worried. I agree, Scott. I'm actually a little worried. Do you know that there is a remake trying to be made of this right now?
Yeah, yeah.
It's Little Shop, really?
Yeah,
and I'm a little worried about them doing just that, Scott. Like, taking it into, like, this has to be more real. It can't be silly because people will laugh at it. And I'm like, no, you need to go full blast in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's starring
Edgerton.
One of our new favorite people, Taron Egerton. Who I thought was phenomenal in Rocket Man.
Shit.
Yeah.
Now,
that actually worries me. Movie musicals.
That worries me because he's too good looking. He's too smooth. He's too cool. Like Rick Moranis was a blundering idiot, as a performer, as a persona, and so,
which is where the fear comes from. Where I'm like, oh, so they're trying to make it just, you know, like he's just an attractive guy that wears glasses.
Yeah,
it's okay.
It's so real.
He's just poor.
It does concern me. I got a big thing right now about pretty people, just sticking pretty people in that can't really do what you think that they're going to do.
Well, the next two people that are currently cast in it maybe are that, two Marvel actors. We have, as Audrey, Scarlett Johansson. I don't know.
Really?
Can she sing? I don't know.
Yeah, can she?
I think she has sung before. I think she might have the chops to do it stylistically. And don't get me wrong, I think Edgerton does too. I think he's a really good actor. I just think he's too good looking and too cool. Yeah. I don't hate that. I don't hate ScarJo.
Who's the next one?
And then Chris Evans is the dentist. Now, he's actually, because of his background, because he was he was comedy, right, back in the day. His one of his best roles is not another teen movie.
Yeah.
Where he plays the jock making fun of James Vanderbeek from Varsity Blues.
I did the table read with him for that.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. It's Sony.
Well.
But I didn't. I did.
Of Not Another Teen Movie?
Uh-huh.
Were you the what's his name role? The dad of, who are you?
I don't even remember. I was asked to come in and do the reading because the actor who got cast, who had like one more credit than I did, got the part.
Damn.
Big football guy. You know, and so so I came in and I sat next to Mr. T, and Mr. T got me a bagel. It's one of my favorite Hollywood stories. Yeah. Hey, Scott, what kind of schmear you want? Like yelling across the room.
I want him to yell at me, what kind of schmear do I want?
But, I pity the fool who doesn't like schmear.
Yeah, Chris Evans. I mean, nobody in that room was famous other than Randy Quaid at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Jamie Presley kind of was, I guess. That one kid from Freaks and Geeks was in it. And, you know, some other character actors.
That's fun.
Yeah.
The benefits of Los Angeles.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But Chris Evans, I like Chris Evans a lot. So, and I'd like to see him branch out and get to do some other weirder stuff.
Colloquialism update. Tough titty comes from the 1920s.
That tracks.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and he's also kind of doing a 1920s. I mean, I guess it's supposed to be 60s, but it does always, to me, feel a bit like a 1920s, like jazz host, jazz club host or some MC.
Oh, I always took it as like a 1950s rock and roller Elvis.
Absolutely.
Brando,
which is
kind of
basically just referencing 1920s jazz club.
Fight.
No. I'm not arguing with Scott. I'm saying like America's racist and everything was stolen.
We'll kiss
from black culture. So
what?
Watch the movie Elvis. You'll get what I'm talking about. The movie Elvis presents Elvis like it's an interesting film. It's not. People go see. I don't know. It was fine. I give it like a 65%, 70% maybe. But it does like try to tackle the sort of like Elvis is just stealing what black musicians and stars have been of the time had been doing for years and years and years. He just made it mainstream.
Yeah.
And it like half tackles it. It doesn't really get there.
That's what I was most interested
Baz
in.
Baz Luhrmann's not interested in that shit.
Yeah, come on, Baz.
He's not. It's okay.
Baz.
Remember Great Gatsby? Not good. Okay.
Didn't see it.
It's okay.
Only seen the old
it's
movie.
Okay. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry yourself about it.
Is there any... I want to hear your favorite musical numbers. Are there any songs that are just like your top right away? That's my song from this show.
Well, I love the dentist song. But
so
I think it's
a
the
dentist. That
yeah,
one.
Yeah,
you'll be a success.
Success. Here he is, folks. The leader of the pack.
'60s reference, right?
Yeah, totally.
Littered with. There's a thousand '60s references, which was Barry Pearl's problem with my show. Like,
yeah.
There's all those references. I was like, same shit. We're all
it's
doing
the same. It's all the same thing. It's all cycle. It's all cyclical.
I ran
like
lights
CJ
for
said.
Our high school musical when I was in junior high, and it was called The Leader of the Pack, and it was about the person that wrote all that fucking music. So we knew what was going on in the 90s with The Leader of the Pack.
Yeah.
We knew.
Barry.
Barry.
I love you, Barry.
No, but I love that opening number. I think it's one of the best opening numbers. It gives you everything. It sets up all of your characters perfectly. It sets up the world perfectly. And I dig it. Suddenly Seymour's pretty great. You can't beat that. It's a great duet. And if you have two great actors and performers, that
I just, I loved it, especially like when they came in with that, when she comes in and she's not, she's belting, but still in that ridiculous little voice of hers. And it's so silly, but great. The thing that killed me about the movie, especially not knowing it as well as other people do, is it was so fast. I mean, what, it was 75 minutes before the credits hit? Like, it was really short.
Quick.
And you just trip song into song into song, and I can't remember, because sometimes you get into musicals like that, and after a while it's like another fucking song or another fucking chorus, and I never felt that way about this. I liked everything happening.
Yeah, and it's a tight, I mean, it's a it is a wonderfully tight script. I mean, going back to the original Corman movie, like, even that's a tight script. But they really did a great job of
How long is the live version?
It's not two. I mean, it's about the same. It's two acts.
I think we were running 2 hours with intermission.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty good for 2 hours with intermission is a pretty excellent run for a musical.
Yeah, we kept it tight. We kept it pretty tight. It was a fast-paced little shot for sure. But I think you could stretch it out on accident and
make it
too long. I really love Suddenly Seymour. I really love the song from the ending that was cut. It's called We'll Have Tomorrow. And it's this song you can actually find it on YouTube. It's Mankin and Ashman singing it to each other. It's kind of funny.
Oh.
But it's they actually put that on the off Broadway. Or no, it was on the new cast recording or something. If you look that up. But it's called We'll Have Tomorrow. And the idea is we're going to be okay. It doesn't matter what happens to us. I love you. I'm going to go kill this plant. So it's the moment right before he goes to kill it. And it's a beautiful, beautiful song, but it's heart-wrenching because you kind of know what's coming. Mm-hmm. And then he goes and does all the stuff, and then Audrey gets eaten by it while he's going to get the final meal for the plant, and he pulls her out, and then they sing just like one tiny verse of "We'll Have Tomorrow." We'll have tomorrow. Everything's fine. So I re-put that back in my show, and I didn't tell the rights. Licensing.
Bailey.
I know.
And their licensing is real intense.
Yeah, and this really already happened though. So what are they gonna do?
Take that bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. What else? What are other? I just got a pop-up of Grogu from Mandalorian, which brings me back to the
puppet.
That's crazy. Yeah, he just popped up. The puppet stuff, though, I think with Disney right now and the Mandalorian and all these things, they are, because it's Disney Plus, it is a bit of a lower budget. And so I think there's half of them is like, we can do puppetry and save some money on CGI.
Yeah.
And we can kind of make everybody nostalgic again for that. But I just don't see a trajectory of it. I want to see practical shit back in movies.
Agreed.
Everywhere.
Agreed.
I was a little mad Multiverse of Madness didn't have more practical shit just because Sam Raimi is sort of the king of practical, right? There was just that part of me that really missed it.
Yeah. I dig exactly what you're saying. Absolutely agree.
I like puppets.
Absolutely agree.
Frank Oz does this without Jim Henson. Henson had not passed yet. He passes 3 years later.
Not a little bit later.
But they had always directed together. They had always worked on things together. This was Frank Oz's first outing without Henson. But obviously Henson and like the Henson brothers are two of the puppeteers. Like it's like
sure.
Brian Henson was one of them. And then
you know, around the same time, we also have Dark Crystal, we have Labyrinth, and all of those amazing and dark
never
and creepy
ending
puppets.
Story.
But Never Ending Story doesn't have puppets quite like
it does.
Those
it
other
had
two.
Falcor.
It has puppets. It does have,
it
have
does.
Puppets.
It has the
puppets.
No,
Henson.
First of all,
they're not Henson.
I think they are. It's just not a Henson produced. I think they bought. I think they are.
Oh, maybe
Henson.
They
do.
You're right. You're right.
But
you're right.
Falcor is crazy. The snail early on in the movie, but then the giant turtle.
No, I'm wrong. I'm
There's
wrong.
So many.
I'm
yeah,
wrong.
Dude.
I said I'm wrong.
You're wrong. I'm
Say
gonna
it one more
beat
time.
You later for it.
And while we're beating you, you have to.
Now you guys can't come over tomorrow.
I'm wrong.
What?
I'm wrong.
Now you guys can't come over tomorrow.
No.
How does that feel?
No, yeah. I want to come over. I want to hang out with you guys.
Yeah. You do now.
I want to hang out. Is this a Greek tragedy? Is that why there's a Greek chorus?
I don't think so. Well,
it could
I don't
be
know.
The
movie's
not.
Because
the movie
of hubris.
Is not.
There's hubris. Yeah, I was literally just about to say this. It's a character.
He's
being
doing
it follows
it
the arc of a Greek tragedy. Yeah. The musical, to be clear. The movie is not.
It's its own thing. Yeah. Well, yeah. No, it was great. I it was really fun to rewatch it, and because it's so embedded in my brain, like it's just a show that's embedded in my brain, and and when I think about the show, I think about the movie. I don't think about the play, despite seeing many productions and being in many productions.
I guess it's time for me to be in one.
You need to see it, be in it, be part of it. We could put up my little shop again if we wanted to. Why not?
I want
to
be the dentist or Bill Murray.
No, I would do something different.
No, I'm not, doing, I'm not doing anything weirdo like that. I'm not doing anything weirdo like that. Girls are girls and boys are boys.
Oh,
I
no.
literally had to listen to a conversation like this at work today. I was just like...
No.
It was just horrible.
I'm glad I work alone.
Oh,
mostly.
My God. It was me listening to a recording of a conversation, to be fair, which is part of my job. And so... One of it was our employee not pressing buttons, but this guy was he had stuff to say and he was gonna say it about gender.
Oh,
it was the worst. It was the worst.
Well, to be clear, we all agree that gender is a construct. We've said it 1,000 times on this podcast. Don't delete Scott. We love him.
Like Tom, fuck gender.
I'm joking. Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah. yeah, sure. I'm with you. Is there anything else y'all want to talk about Little Shop?
No, I think we've covered it. Like it was a huge, it became a huge thing. I think also one of the reasons that it survived was because, like, what happens whenever a movie version of a musical comes out is that it spawned all these productions.
Yeah.
Then the video came out, the home video version, and then that's what the cult thing came from, was that they were informing each other. Productions of the play, of the musical, were informing the popularization of the
right.
film.
Absolutely. Yeah. Siege, final thought?
Yay, I'm glad I sat down and had a good watch of this. And I knew I would enjoy it and everything, but, you know, it's fun to watch something like this that was a weird part of my childhood, and now I've rewatched it and I love it.
Right, good. Totally.
So good. Phenomenal film. Everybody go rewatch it. Always good times. Everyone's incredible in it. We didn't really do, like, a performance review, but there's no failures here.
No, no,
everyone understands the assignment.
Yeah, everyone gets it and kills
from
it.
Mushnick down to the chorus to the, you know, the ensemble. Yeah. And it's absolutely incredible. Fuck. Y'all got any of those things that put light on a spot in Los Angeles theater?
LA Spotlight.
Any LA Spotlights?
No, there's still a lot of fringe encore performances happening all over the place, all over Hollywood. So go to the Fringe website. Really, some amazing stuff that is just now, because of scheduling and summertime and all that, are just now getting those little runs after the Fringe Festival. But well worth your time and well worth your money. Go check it out.
Freestyle Love Supreme, I believe, has two more weeks once this comes out. So, a week and a half once this comes out. So get your tickets. Come check it out at the Pasadena Playhouse. Siege, you got any spitlets?
I do not.
Perfect.
Thank you for asking, though.
You're welcome for asking, though. Thank you for joining us for another Theater bonus mini-series. Join us next week as we do part 3 of this miniseries, and Pam will be joining us. We'll have Pam Quinn here, and we're covering Into the Woods next time, and then the episode after that will be the new Spielberg West Side Story, which I'm also very excited to talk about. And then Jonathan Larson.
Yeah,
let's close it out.
Do y'all have questions, comments, compliments? You can email us, or you can also reach us at Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
It's true.
And you're about to hear it right now. Also, a big shout out to Pam Quinn for writing our special and stuff bonus theme song, which you heard at the beginning of this episode. Pam will be joining us next week, and we love her. And finally, to the great Pulitzer Prize winning playwright, Annie Baker.
Oh.
What?
Nothing.
She writes every single one of our episodes, and she doesn't even know it. One day, Annie Baker, we're going to buy you a beer.
Yes. I love that bit still. Whether we interrupt you or you pause or use your
You're waiting for us.
So Annie Baker.
It's so Annie Baker.
Yeah.
We should have t-shirts made.
We really should.
So Annie Baker.
Actually, we should have merch. Why don't we have merch yet?
We should start having merch. We could totally do that. Yeah.
People would buy it. Mouths and butts are the same thing, just on the front and back of a shirt.
Yeah.
I want a beer koozie that says that.
Yeah, or if it says mouths on the front, butts on the back, but then in parentheses under
same
both,
thing.
It says same thing. Everybody would buy that. I know for
buttons
a fact.
And beer koozies. I'm down for it.
Yeah. Mouths and butts are the same thing. It has been a dead bit for a while, but it lasted like 50-something
episodes.
Dead
horse.
And it'll come back around.
It'll come back around, as they always do. Anyway, we love you all. Subscribe, rate, review, but, like, actually do it. Review it. Subscribe. That would help so much. We like seeing those numbers tick up. We've been getting a lot of Instagram followers, a lot of love from people reaching out, so thank you. Friend Sophia, I don't know her last name, but Sophia reached out and was like, do Shanghai and so I can write a thesis paper. And we're like, oh, don't base your thesis paper on our podcast. And she's like, no, I just like your insight. So do more stuff like that. Reach out. We love you.
Yeah, totes.
On the 23rd day of the month of September, in an early year of a decade not too long before our own, the human race suddenly encountered a deadly threat to its very existence. And this terrifying enemy surfaced, as such enemies often do, in the seemingly most innocent and unlikely of podcasts.
later, everybody.
Tough titties.
I'm going to put a song at the end. Listen all the way.
All the way through. Later, everybody. Love you.
The theater. The theater.
Theater.
To be or not to be.
Don't you be frightened. Don't be afraid. I'll get us out of this mess that I made. Don't ask questions tonight. It's touch and go. No one ever got hurt by what they don't know. We'll have tomorrow. Trust me, it's true. We'll have tomorrow. We'll get through. Clouds will be parted. Sun will shine bright.
I'm fine. I'll come for you after Life magazine, take you away to that development you dream about. And once we're there, everything will be happy ever after. I promise.
We'll have a family. Three kids or four.
Don't you be frightened. Don't be afraid. If we see tomorrow, we've got it made.